Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to Kudzu Vine for August 2nd, 2017. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, we got an exciting show tonight. We got topics to talk about because things are happening in our home state, which were pretty major news late in the week. But then we got us a great guest, a new guest that our friend from Daily Coast, David Neer, put us in touch with. Stephen Wolf, just a really good writer, mainly on redistricting and voting rights access, but he knows about all kind of things. And he's a really good Twitter follow. I did not even realize when we got him booked, I already follow his Twitter feed. So I'm familiar with his work without putting together. He's the cookie monster, if you will. That's his icon. I'm going to ask him about that. But until Stephen comes on about 20 minutes into the podcast, we're going to talk about the news of Thursday night. If you were in Georgia, most likely not, I mean, anywhere that was in the Atlanta viewing area, every station of the four major networks preempted programming. WSB preempted every hour of their programming. This story was so big. It was the 285 bridge collapse. I can't imagine if you're listening to a show, you haven't at least heard
not 285.
About the incident. I'm sorry.
Not
I'm 285. Sorry. I-85. I'm driving, so I'm real confused. But yes, I-85, it's just north of the city, the main midtown city of Atlanta, between Buckhead and Midtown was that little piece. Before they come together on 75 and 85, had one of those collapse. No telling what the after effects will be. But, Catherine, since it's down the closest to you, just give us your opening thoughts on it.
Well, it was really interesting Thursday evening when I left work. I work in downtown Atlanta. I walked out of my office towards my park at the parking deck and came across a huge collection of police and bomb squad and all this activity right downtown. Turns out there had been some kind of suspicion of red mercury, which turns out to be sort of a undefined chemical. Anyway, they thought there was some suspicion of some red mercury. So there was all this activity, and we're like, what in the heck's going on here? You know, we didn't know what it was. Well, we just kept going and got in our cars and went off to go home. I was walking with a coworker. Well, as soon as I got on the road, this was like around 5 o'clock, a little after five. There's all of a sudden I hear all these sirens. I'm headed home. I go home. I work downtown. I live on the west side, so I have to cross the highway. But I don't get on the highway. I'm you know in town. So there's all this traffic. I mean, traffic is usually bad that time of night anyway. So it didn't really occur to me that there was anything dramatic going on, except there were a lot of sirens, and I was like, what's going on? What? I didn't notice anything when I crossed the highway. I got home, and I got a text from a friend, oh, my God, I-85 collapsed. So then, of course, I watched the news for the remaining of the evening and got to listen to the reporters who had nothing to report but just kept talking, of course. But, you know, it's horrible. It's going to be have horrible impact on business across the southeast. I mean, it's not – this is a major highway. The only saving grace really is 285 because most traffic, motor traffic that does not stop in Atlanta, goes around Atlanta by going 285 because large trucks can't come into the city unless – they're delivering inside the city. So they have to take 285. So that's a saving grace, but it's going to be horrible for, especially now we have a new baseball stadium that just opened.
Oh.
Now that's the impact on that is mostly on the 75 routes, but it's all going to have an impact. And it's going to be months before it's really, could be, they said 4 to 8 months before it's rebuilt and fully functioning.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to try to go closer to the 4 months than the 8 months. This is not a stadium project, if you will. This is one that they're going to have to push to push the timeline up drastically. Tim, what were some of your initial thoughts?
Well, my first thought was, my son. He takes that road quite a bit, but he had been on it earlier in the day, right there on that same exact spot, and which I understand there's what, like either 250,000 or 350,000 people a day use that stretch of road, something like that.
The number I heard was 250,000.
Yeah, it is a huge amount of people, and my son is one of them that has to use it quite a bit. He, by then, thank goodness, was on his way up here, and it's just remarkable that no one was, hurt or killed or something. Because
no injuries.
Talking about 350 feet of highway on each side of the highway gone. Part of it collapsed. The other part was so damaged they had to take it down. And, of course, we talk about the political stuff on here. This, as Catherine has already mentioned, is not welcome news for those who support the new Braves Stadium. They'll be playing their opening game there, I think, on the 14th. And it's going to make a difficult traffic situation even worse there, of course. Another bunch that'll be on the spot, of course, is the federal government. I understand they've already provided $10 million for startup of the job in emergency fund, but much, much more in the way of resources have to come in, and quickly. The public does not want to see slowdowns or on such a vital project caused by, shall we say, government foot dragging or inaction. The sixth district race, I even heard that it could be impacted by this, and the talk would turn to rail. What, have you heard anything about that particular aspect, David?
Well, yeah, and I think we'll get to the after effects politically, and there's several strands that are going to come off of this. But just right after, one of my initial thoughts, Catherine, I think we were texting back and forth even more than Tim and myself or you and Tim right after, and that was about the MARTA portion of this, because it was unclear, since the MARTA line runs right next to there, if it was having to close for safety, but apparently it continued to run and it had no impact safety-wise,
right.
So it continued to run. So that's another saving grace for commuters. Obviously, the number one saving grace of this whole situation, zero lost lives or injuries, and that
right.
Kudos go out to the Atlanta Fire Department and other safety officials that moved everybody back, and, of course, fire officials knowing when to pull their team back so that not a single person was injured or killed, because, they had to, of course, close the lanes. With the fire, they were going to close those pretty quickly because you probably couldn't drive through the smoke. And then I've been on top of a fire where there's concrete when Atlanta Stadium was on fire that time, and that was a minimal fire compared. And it was, you could feel the heat as we were evacuating, and the rubber was literally burnt, melting and sticking to your shoes. And so I know how quickly that happens, and therefore you couldn't put tires across that once even just the fire got going, even before they thought there'd be structural damage that would have caused it to collapse. But as far as the strands, and there's so many political strands, one's going to be, even though this was something that hopefully could have been avoidable based on the reports we've heard, it still gets into, you want other options for transportation. It's also going to get into storage of material. It's going to get into how we look at homelessness and drug addiction, because we hadn't got into that. And early reports, and nothing's 100% confirmed, but I don't know if you can confirm it concretely until there's a trial or what have you, but early reports from three individuals, one of which seems to be the perpetrator. The other two were there, and they were said to be homeless. One was said to have smoked crack before it happened, although the way it was explained by one of the other people, he put a chair on a shopping cart, lit it on fire, and of all the bad things crack can do to you, I don't know that it makes you into a pyromaniac. That seems like this person just, if it's true, wanted to do that. And apparently this stuff was fenced off. So you got all those lines of thinking, and then people are going to have to put that, and that may be on their mind when they vote. How are they going to want to look at how transportation funds are spent? Maybe some people somehow think race impacts homelessness and drug treatment. Don't know that that lines up as well, but all those things people could be voting on. Catherine, do you think there's a real impact on that special election right off?
You know, I hadn't occurred to that, and it hadn't occurred to me, and I hadn't seen a report of that. I think the biggest thing, if there is any impact, it's going to be about transportation, because I think there should be a few people that are in that district that may be impacted by this, so they may be more concerned about transportation now than they were before, about, you know, alternatives to driving. But apparently MARTA was really busy. There are lots of people using it on Friday and over the weekend, and, quickly, adapted to using it. So that's good news. If people can, if that's the only, good outcome of something like this, that's, something to think about. My question, I think the storage of these kind of materials, apparently from, I guess, Google footage of that space, Google map footage, some of those, like those materials have been there for as much as 10 years and maybe longer.
So most likely. Yeah.
Pardon?
PVC pipe gets old and brittle quickly. So one would think you would not newly install 10-year-old PVC pipe.
Right. Well, it was. They keep referring to it as PVC pipe, but it was actually like made out of high density foam, which is why it was so flammable. But that stuff shouldn't have been stored there. There's all kinds of rules against it. I mean, I've seen a couple of reports about, here are the rules against storing stuff like this. And if you are going to, and whenever you store anything under a highway, there's very specific rules about how big the storage site is, how tall, how high, how, wide, what kind of, and all those rules have been broken for that particular storage for what was stored there. So while, it wouldn't have happened apparently allegedly, but for this drug using homeless man, if it hadn't been there, it wouldn't have been able to start on fire. So, we have to put blame in all areas. And it also, it wasn't secure. It was supposed to be secured, and it wasn't. So that's really tragic.
And I don't know if the fence had locks and gates, how high the fence was. Sometimes when they're in the project's really, really active, they may throw some stuff under a bridge quickly, because if not, they would just be throwing it somewhere else, and they're using it. But, 10 years is quite a long time a year, 10 months is quite a long time to just store stuff up that you haven't used on a project, because but you want these things to be rapid. Now, of course, this gentleman, obviously, if the reports are true, he very deranged. Just to light a fire that was so dangerous under a bridge, anyone with any common sense would know that's not safe at all. Because I'd heard some reports that somebody said, well, the person might have been just starting a fire to dry their clothes, because sometimes people that live under bridges, because a bridge is honestly, if you have no place to live, better than a lot of other places to live. and people will start fires to dry their clothes and whatnot. But this was not the case. This was not a out-of-control fire that was had a, you know, semi-legit purpose. This was somebody purposely doing it. And so I think, you know,
at least that's what we think.
There are going to people look at this. I mean, it's going to be all looked at, not just one thing. Tim, what do you think? Maybe just let's deal with the transportation part of it.
Well, yeah, that it's interesting that in that 6th district race, there had been some talk, you know, among the candidates, especially in the debates and whatnot, about the expansion of rail and the creation of regional panels for, you know, to develop a transit system. And wouldn't you know, talk about bad moments in timing. House Bill 160, Senate Bill 6, dealt with that very thing, the development of regional panels to look into building up a transit system to the outlying areas of the metro area. And wouldn't you know that on that very day, they died, those two bills died their death in the legislature down there. So there are going to be some big questions about that. There's going to have to be a huge question about it. You know, we've talked about this a lot on this show, how dependent the metro area is on, you know, cars. And that's the basket they put all their eggs in. When other cities, like you go to Chicago and, you know, 60 miles from Chicago, you can jump on the train right on into Chicago in a little bit. You can ride all over New York in one. I mean, Moscow, Russia has one of the best systems in the world. And Atlanta is like the 6th largest metro area now in the country. And they're just going to have to address this head on. Maybe this tragic thing that happened will hasten that day. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, and I do think there's two things with transportation. And one of them we talk about a lot, and it's needed, and that is rail, bus systems, things that move more people with fewer vehicles. But a second thing a lot of people need to look at is living close to where you work. I live 7 minutes away from work. My wife works 5 minutes away from our home. I mean, and there's a lot to be said, and we don't live in a city, but still, wherever you live, if you can live and work close to each other, that's good. Now, I know people change jobs, but I know people that live in, say, Cobb and work in Gwinnett, and they easily could, you know, switched houses, and they could have decided to live and work in Gwinnett or live and work in Cobb. And you could do the same thing with Clayton and Fayette or Henry and, you know, Douglas. Or, I'm sorry, Henry. Yeah, Henry and Douglas really good. That's a lot of driving. And people don't make a lot of sense in where they match their homes and their jobs up. I mean, people need to begin to cut their commute time, whether they jump on a bus, a car, or a train. And that's going to help a lot. I mean, Catherine, I get the sense you don't live that far away from your work either, do you?
I live about, you know, depending on traffic, of course, you know, 10, 15 minutes from work, sometimes longer if the traffic is bad. But I think that rolls into another issue, which is the cost and the expense of housing in Atlanta. I mean, a lot of people who work in Atlanta really can't afford to live here. I mean, it's just a straight.
And wouldn't the train help them if they didn't have to drive every day?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and it's and there and it's because people that are younger, people probably Generation X, certainly millennials, they're beginning to understand that cities, the things that older generations may have fled from, are just hoaxes and boogeymen that don't exist, and therefore, if you will go ahead and live back in the city, you can help your life, quality of life, not a lot.
David, let me ask you to welcome our guest on.
All right. Welcome him to the first time to the Kudzu Vine from Daily Kos, among other publications, Mr. Stephen Wolf. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Yes, well, Stephen, we did a little bit of intro that, you know, David Neer put you in contact with us, and that you have quite a Twitter account that's very active that we actually follow with the Kudzu Vine feed. But just kind of give us a general bio, political background bio, what have you.
All right. Well, I graduated from the University of North Carolina with a degree in political science about 2 years ago, and I've been writing for Daily Coast Elections ever since. My main focus is on voting rights, redistricting, election reform, and making maps of election results.
Yes, and so, and are you from North Carolina or from somewhere else?
Yep.
Okay. How ironic, our guest last week, North Carolina University. So I guess that's where we need to get our next guest if we're going to have a three-peat.
just Steve, as long as they didn't go to Duke.
Yes. Well, and you've got I don't think I had a Duke professor or anything for whatever reason. Now we have no problem with any colleges necessarily if they get political information, but for whatever reason we hadn't. I mentioned your Twitter feed, and it was funny. I didn't put it together until like the next day when I looked on Twitter, and one of your posts came up. I actually followed you, and I see that you have a Cookie Monster icon, if you will. What's that about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would think of myself as a cookie enthusiast, I guess. I just thought it was amusing, and you know, I put it on there as a joke, and people liked it, and so I've kept it.
Yes, well, I like the information too. Nothing against the Cookie Monster, but it's really great data, and you're right. The maps you put up and showing how districts could be configured and how that might change things are very informative. But well, I don't think we're doing as much on redistricting tonight because there's just other topics. And I'm going to go ahead and pass it off to Tim and Catherine, and they're going to come back to me later with some political stuff. Tim?
No. Good evening, Mr. Wolf, and thank you for being on with us tonight. Let me start by saying, as I told my friend Tom Jensen, I'm a Georgia Tech guy, and my heart is with the ACC tomorrow night. That being said, we'll move on. On Daily Coast, you've talked a lot about redistricting reform and about the need for, shall we say, nonpartisan commissions in the affected states. But with the Republicans in total control of so many states now, is that a realistic hope anytime soon?
Well, it really depends on the state, because the states that we've seen in recent years and decades implement these nonpartisan commissions have been the kind of states mm-hmm. that have ballot initiatives like California. And so what this lets them do is say, okay, legislators aren't going to give up this power voluntarily. Well, we can just sidestep them entirely by putting it right before the people on a statewide vote. And so states that mm-hmm. could achieve redistricting reform this way that would really make a big difference are Florida, Michigan, and Ohio, where Republicans have all drawn these kind of really strong gerrymanders at either the state or the congressional level. And so, mm-hmm. yes, there are a few states that you really could make a big difference without any Republican support. On the other hand, you have other, you know, really populous Republican-drawn states like Texas, where the legislature has total authority over redistricting, and with Republicans in control of the legislature and drawing their own district lines, it's really kind of hard to dislodge them and hard to expect reform to happen at any point in the future. And so for states like that, where we're really left with is litigation. And so there are a couple of cases working their way up through the judicial system this year, with one case to watch in Wisconsin that might go to the Supreme Court in the coming term, where plaintiffs are trying to argue that partisan gerrymandering itself is unconstitutional. And so mm-hmm. the court has historically said, you know, that's not an acceptable grounds for striking down a map. You know, we might mm-hmm. invalidate a map based on abusing race, but we're not going to do it based on party. And so what these cases are hoping is that the justices will arrive at a different outcome in their own case. And so those will definitely be something to watch in the next year or two.
So you know, historically, redistricting has been handled on a state-by-state basis by the various states. Do you think the future could involve, especially from the litigation standpoint, the development of a standardized system for every state in the United States to use equally?
Well, I mean, that's how other countries typically handle drawing their own districts. They'll have nationally run elections. But, of course, the U.S. does not have national elections. We leave it up to the states. There have been a few congressmen, such as Jim Cooper from Tennessee, have kind of pushed these bills that would mandate all of the states set up their own redistricting commission, and still leaving it to the states to have some degree of control, but not leaving it up to their legislators, per se. But those bills really don't have much of a chance of passing in Congress just because, you know, the people elected right now benefit from the current system so much that, you know, even if you're a Democrat who might want to elect more Democrats, you could come from a state where supporting redistricting reform in your state would at least hurt you personally. And so just in terms of the chances of that happening at the national level, I just don't see it. Now, what we could see with a Supreme Court decision, of course, that would apply everywhere. It's just up to, you know, the court to find a standard that they like that they can say, okay, well, we're going to strike down districts if they, you know, exceed the, you know, acceptable amount of partisanship based on this statistic or something along those lines. Or say, you know, drawing districts on partisanship, you know, violates the First Amendment. It's a free speech claim. We're going to go case by case. And so it really just depends on what the Supreme Court decides to do with these upcoming cases.
All right, and with that, I'll pass it over to Catherine. Catherine?
All right.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for being on. I'm a big fan of these commissions. I, here in Georgia, we have incredibly ridiculous state district. The district I live in is actually quite hilarious, the way it was rewritten in 2010 or whenever it was. I'm wondering what you think about this sort of, I guess it's not even a rumor anymore, this idea that former Attorney General, whose name is just completely slipping my mind.
Eric Holder
and yep. Former President Obama working on redistricting policy. What do you think about that? Do you think that could have any legs?
Yeah, I do. It's really interesting that you bring that up because it's called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, and it's an explicitly Democratic-backed group. And so they're not coming at it from the perspective of, you know, we just want good government, we want reform. You know, they're saying, you know, we do want fairer lines, but, you know, we're also wanting fairer lines because it will help our party. And, you know, that's fine because, you know, fairer lines are good on their own. But they're not going to be trying to do what these independent groups are doing. So they instead can have someone like, you know, former President Obama come in and go to a fundraiser and, you know, raise a couple $1 million for the project. Whereas, you know, these reform groups who are trying to, say, put an initiative on the ballot, they often don't want to be associated with either party. And so what the National Democratic Group is designed to do is to help Democrats win these races for governor or state legislature in these key states that will help the party improve its position for redistricting. And, you know, that could really go a long way just because state legislative races really don't see the kind of flood of campaign spending that federal races do, at least yet. And so, you know, if you dropped $1 million on a state Senate race in Georgia or North Carolina, that goes a really long way.
And so, a really long way.
Yeah, a really long way. And so having, you know, the national party say, we're going to raise tens or even a couple $100 million for this over the long term, that could make a big difference. And it's something that Republicans successfully did in the last round of redistricting, that they had this organization called Red Map, where, you know, they had the national party raise money and then target select districts across the country that would, you know, win them control of state legislatures. And they were fortunate that, you know, 2010 was a very Republican-leaning midterm year. And so Democrats just can't afford to be caught unprepared like that, and hopefully they won't be.
Well, one thing that I've often said is that, you know, here in Georgia, the Republicans have only been in control for, about a decade, I guess. And prior to that, the Democrats were terrible about redistricting. You know,
right.
It's sort of like, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, what's good for one is good for another, but you can understand why they feel like they have the right or the privilege or whatever to to draw these maps, because they were victims of them for, you know, generations here in Georgia. So it's tricky. I mean, I commend the idea of these independent commissions, and I know that there was some legislation introduced here in Georgia last year and then reintroduced this year, bipartisan, to create one of those commissions, but I'm sure it didn't pass because it would be ridiculous to think that it could in our legislatures. But I'm encouraged that people are thinking about this, because I've been thinking about it for a long time, but a lot of people just don't understand how these things work. And to bring more light to it, I think, and to lift it up, I think is really helpful, because I think it helps people to understand why they feel like they aren't represented and that these are the reasons.
Right. And I think, you know, especially given that we've had, you know, several high-profile legal battles over redistricting in states like North Carolina, voters probably do have much more of an appreciation of what redistricting does than they have in past decades. And so I do think we're seeing some progress on the public opinion front. It's just really tough to kind of overcome these partisan divisions. And so, you know, when you take an issue and make it partisan, you know, it's very hard to build a bipartisan coalition. And so reformers really have to kind of thread that needle.
And they're working at a disadvantage, because they don't have the, I mean, ideally they don't have the support of the, either they have equal support from both parties, or they have, or they're running on their own. So they're,
right.
They don't have the benefit
yeah.
of that, the influence of the parties. Well, that's really
right,
interesting.
Exactly.
And thank you for writing about it. It's really helpful. And on that, I'm going to pass it back to David.
Yes. Well, Stephen, they gave me a lot of political stuff to ask about it. I'm going to do that. One of the special elections, we have five of them coming up, and they're all different degrees of competitive. But one that has really the fairest district you can get would be the Montana at-large seat. There's no way anybody can monkey around with those district lines. They're just what they are. How do you see that race playing out, being a high-profile but very liberal candidate against just typical Republican in that special election?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Montana as not being able to be gerrymandered, because, you know, while that's true, ironically, Democrats haven't won the election for that district in about two decades. So it is a Republican state. Donald Trump won Montana by about 20% or so. And on the other hand, though, Montana has been much more open to electing Democrats at the statewide level than other similar red states. I mean, it has a Democratic governor. It elected a Democratic senator in 2012. And those are all hard-fought contests that, you know, Democrats prevailed in despite having millions of dollars spent against them. And so Democrats, you know, have some reasons to be hopeful that, you know, they could pull off an upset if the stars align here. But on the other hand, you know, Montana is a red state, and it's an overwhelmingly white state as well. And white voters who live there, you know, they're not especially, you know, well-educated. And why that's important is because in 2016 and, you know, even in prior elections, we've seen Democrats do progressively worse with, you know, white voters who don't have a college education. And so in terms of this upcoming special election, you know, we might normally expect Democrats to lose this race, even though they might do all right. You know, they might get to 45% of the vote without breaking a sweat. It's really just getting that extra, you know, getting over the 50% bump that's just so difficult. But the two candidates you have, Democrats went with a, you know, a first-time candidate, Rob Quist, who is a popular Montana musician, you know, has a long history in the state, just has never held elective office. And so he won their nomination, you know, kind of on this economic populist platform of, you know, championing the issues Bernie Sanders really kind of promoted in the primary, where Quist is, you know, promoting passing single-payer health care, you know, tackling income inequality and that sort of thing. And so that's an issue that has historically, or economic populism has historically benefited Democrats, especially out west, because their coalition relied so heavily on white voters who were more working class. And so it'll be interesting to see if Quist can get a lot of traction out of that in Montana, because he'll obviously need to win over some Trump voters to, you know, win the election. And if you're going to try to peel off Trump voters, you know, there are plenty of them who, you know, they are low income. You know, they might benefit from these policies and recognize it in this candidate. And so that's Democrats' hope in that election. Of course, on the other hand, you know, Greg Gianforte is very wealthy. I mean, he spent $6 million of his own money in his gubernatorial election in 2016, which he only narrowly lost. He's raised a lot more money than Quist has, and, you know, he's a pretty generic Republican in a state that has favored generic Republicans recently. So I would be very surprised to see Democrats win that election, but, you know, I wouldn't bet my life on them losing it.
Yeah, I guess I see Montana as more optimistic because of John Tester. Steve Beshear is the one from Kentucky. They have a current Steve Bullock.
Steve Bullock, governor before.
Max Baucus. I mean, they've had so many Democrats. And, like, for instance, we'll get to it later, the Georgia 6th District. But I want to ask about the other two states that get no attention, South Carolina and Kansas, Mick Mulvaney's seat, Mike Pompeo's seat that he's vacating. Which one of those, if either, is a decent chance to even just take a shot at?
I mean, those are both so heavily Republican seats. You know, if I had to guess, I'd say probably South Carolina, the 5th District there, is a little more hospitable to Democrats. But it's also a lot more polarized, where, you know, the types of Trump voters Democrats would need to peel off, they've been voting Republican up and down the ballot for a very long time. And that's really the case in Kansas, too. Let's see. You had Trump win Kansas's 4th by an almost 2-1 margin. You know, he won in South Carolina by about 18%. And it's just really difficult for a Democrat to overcome those sorts of margins. And, you know, especially with the National Party has expressed almost no interest in either of these seats. And it's not even clear in South Carolina who the Democratic nominee is going to be at this point.
Yes. Well, now I'm going to finally get to Georgia's 6th Congressional District, the special election that's getting the most attention. And I'll tell you, I was a little slow to come around on this, and I guess it's the fact that even though it's been 10 years ago, 10 years ago was the last time that I worked the 6th Congressional District as a consultant. A gentleman named Steve Senton found Air America, you know, good polished candidate that was a good speaker, came nowhere close. The same year I worked my own congressional district, we had a gentleman that printed 15-yard signs, and they all said Democrat on them. And if I'm not mistaken, that gentleman with 15-yard signs, no money, didn't even spell the word Democrat correctly on his sign, did better in the 6th congressional district. And that's why I guess I was just slow to think, man, this thing's actually possible. But now we're seeing polls. We saw the results of the election at the presidential level, even though, you know, Tom Price did better in his own race. Why is that race caught so much attention from an outsider's perspective, unlike us that are all in state having different views?
Well, just looking at the numbers, you can see Georgia's 6th District, it's been a Republican district for decades. I mean, it was former Speaker Newt Gingrich's House seat in the 1990s, and it's been fairly red ever since. But Hillary Clinton only lost there by about 1%, which was a huge improvement from Obama's performance in 2012. And we can see why this likely was the case, that it's, you know, swung so sharply Democratic. This is by far the most educated district in the country that Democrats don't already hold. Something like nearly two-thirds of white voters there have a college degree. And so this is a demographic that just really kind of rejected Trump compared to how they've treated previous Republican presidential nominees. And the presidential result in a district is very strongly correlated with how the down ballot candidates do. And so if this special upcoming special election with Democrat John Ossoff ends up turning out closer to how the 2016 presidential election turned out, you know, he could have a real fighting chance of winning here in what was, you know, previously thought a safely Republican seat.
Yeah, I tell you that's interesting about education and college, because one thing in Georgia, for many years now, I've had the Hope Scholarship, and a lot of people say that the Hope Scholarship takes money from other communities and puts it on the north side of Metro Atlanta, the 6th district being right in the heart of that. And I actually postulated to Tim and Catherine, I think in the past week, that I'm hoping that the Ossoff campaign or any other Democratic campaign that's really thinking about this will get absentee ballots or get people to go home and vote that are in college, because I think that district has a lot of college age, you know, maybe they don't have their degree yet, but they're in college and they're probably much more, you know, liberal and open-minded than their parents even. And therefore, if they can turn out in bigger numbers than would traditionally be in a special election, that could be a big factor. So I'm wondering to see if that comes to play. Have you heard any kind of indications that there's any kind of get-out-the-vote effort with college-educated or college students living outside the district or attending outside the district?
Well, I haven't heard anything in particular about that, about, you know, any, you know, special strategy for, you know, mobilizing college-age people. I'm sure the campaign is that's one of their goals, just as it is other, you know, core groups from the Democratic base. But in terms of what we have seen, the early voting numbers, the early votes and absentees have started to trickle in the past week. So the election is on April 18th, and we've had about, you know, a week of these early vote numbers coming in. And so far, they look much better for Democrats than they did at an equivalent point in the race in this area in 2014, which is, you know, kind of one of the previous years where we have equivalently good data. It's still very early in terms of using early votes, or it's early in the race to be using early votes as a, you know, strong predictor of the outcome. But, you know, if we're seeing a sort of surge of Democratic enthusiasm here that, you know, we've gotten kind of a hint of across the country, you know, that really could help Ossoff, you know, eke out at a surprise victory, just because special elections are, you know, they really can have just weird results that we wouldn't expect just based on the district statistics. And that's because each just special election race is so dependent upon which groups turn out to vote, and much more so than your regular general election.
Yes, well, that'll be interesting to look at. And I saw those charts that Michael McDonald did. One other thing, that they had a special election in a House seat just a few years ago, and it was Brookhaven. It's one of the last Republican areas of DeKalb County, and Taylor Bennett won the seat in a special election, then lost in a regular election. And so it was a case where, not following the trends in Georgia in the past, a Democrat did better in a special election than they did in a regular. So I'm hoping we can replicate that on a bigger scale. One final thing I wanted to ask you about, then I'll let Tim and Catherine, if I hadn't picked the bones clean, I wanted to ask about the Senate race in Texas. Ted Cruz's seat, Beto O'Rourke, a congressman from El Paso, has already announced. There's thoughts that one of the Castro brothers may also announce. And so, really, you know, high-profile Democrats with jobs or have had jobs are looking at this thing, so you know it's real. Is defeating a guy like Ted Cruz pretty critical for the Democratic hopes of retaking the U.S. Senate in 2018?
Yeah, I would say, in fact, it's essential, just because, you know, every seat that is less Democratic than Texas is probably one that they would almost certainly have to win alongside Texas, just to have a one-seat majority in the Senate. Because once you, you know, go past Texas in terms of other red states, you're talking about states that are overwhelmingly Republican, like Tennessee or Mississippi, that, you know, just don't have this history of even giving Democrats over 40% of the vote in midterm elections. And so while, you know, Ted Cruz starts off as a strong favorite, you know, I think if Democrats are having a very good election year like they did in 2006 when George W. Bush was very unpopular, you know, we might see them take a look at this state and say, hey, maybe, you know, maybe we can just get dip our toes in the water and see if something happens.
Yes, well, I think that's going to be one to see. And plus, if you just had to pick somebody to defeat in the U.S. Senate, I don't know that you could start many better places than Ted Cruz. I'm going to pass it one last time in case they have anything else to Tim than Catherine. Tim?
Yes, sir. I want to turn my attention for just a moment to the national stuff. We've been hearing some rumblings in recent days, especially after the health care debacle in the House, that Donald Trump is making, shall we say, overtones of reaching out to Democrats. Paul Ryan obviously took it very seriously with his comments, but considering the overall state of things in Washington, D.C. right now, politically speaking, is there really any upside to the Democrats working with Donald Trump on anything?
No, I mean, I really don't think so. I think, you know, we've entered a very polarized age where the parties are just so far apart on the issues, and they are behaving almost like parties do in a parliamentary system where, you know, it's uniform party line votes all the time. You know, that's not been the norm in U.S. history, but it's increasingly becoming the case today. And the kinds of proposals Trump might, you know, try to reach out to Democrats with are still going to be very, you know, right of center proposals that would at mm-hmm. least garner the support of enough Republicans to pass. And so it might be one mm-hmm. thing if Democrats held majorities in Congress, but they don't. And so
mm-hmm.
I don't think the types of policies that Trump would propose as compromise would be very palatable to many Democrats. And then from mm-hmm. a purely electoral standpoint, I mean, it's kind of hard to, you know, vote for a guy's policies and then turn around and campaign against them in the next election. Republicans realized under Obama, they opposed everything he did and said, well, Obama's been a very partisan president. You know, they pushed through Obamacare on a party line vote. Well, it's because they opposed it in lockstep. And so there's really just not much electoral incentive for the opposition party to cooperate with the governing party when the governing party has, you know, unified control over the government.
So a thing like, say, tax reform, which they want to tackle next, would probably be a definite non-starter for the Democrats.
Right, because the type of tax reform that they're considering passing is something that, you know, Paul Ryan wants tax cuts for the extremely wealthy. You know, he doesn't want to give big tax breaks to the very poorest of the poor or even the middle class. I mean, it's really all about, you know, satisfying not just the top 1%, but the top 1% of the 1%. And that's something that Democrats just really have little interest in.
All right. And with that, I'm going to send it back to Catherine. Catherine?
I think we've picked the bones clean. But I wanted to I do have one thing for you. What do you think we should be – obviously, you're interested in redistricting. Are there other things that you think we should really be paying attention to or that are bubbling up that we may not see yet?
Oh, well, I think for redistricting, just the most important thing, at least, is that the 2018 elections for governor in, you know, 30-some states that elect their governor that year, those are by far the most important way that we can, you know, really kind of chip down on Republican gerrymandering. Just because you have governors of states like Georgia, where if a Democrat gets elected, they can veto the Republican legislature's maps of Congress
yeah.
and the legislature, and a court will step in and draw the maps. And so that's winning an election for governor when, you know, the incumbent president is unpopular is going to be a lot easier than trying to convince partisans to agree to redistricting reform.
Well, that's good. I like that. Let's win Georgia. governors. Let's do that.
Yeah, really.
Georgia's a key race. It is.
It's going to be a clown car, I imagine, since it's since Governor Deal is term limited. So.
Yep.
We'll have plenty of candidates to select from, I'm sure. Thanks so much for being on tonight. We hope you'll come back.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
David?
Yes. Well, Stephen, I too want to thank you for coming on. And before we let you go, since I mentioned that Twitter feed that you have, give everybody your Twitter handle so they can search you and if they want to start following you.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's PoliticsWolf. It's just all one word.
Yes. Well, and I'm going to, like I said, since I follow you, I'm going to tweet out about the show. I'll tag you in it, and then you can feel free to like it or retweet it or anything you want to do about coming on the Kudzu Vine tonight.
All right. Thanks. Yeah, that sounds good.
Thank you. All right. That was
thank you, sir.
Wolf, among other things, of Daily Kos. I think you've got a byline, a few other places, and, of course, like I said, Twitter. We got time for maybe one, two more quick topics. We hadn't talked about our favorite topic for seemingly about the last year yet. And sometimes you think Donald Trump can't outdo himself, but late in the week, he may have as far as just absent-mindedness. He went to a bill signing, or not even a bill signing, one of his probably proclamations. He put, the steakhouse menus, executive orders. I don't even know what this one is on. I guess it really didn't matter because he talked about it, but never actually put ink to paper and signed it. Apparently Mike Pence, the vice president, had to pick it up and run it back to him to sign. Then they took pictures of it and acted like it never happened, even though there were many people in the room that saw him walk out with the line where his signature was supposed to go blank. There may have been some video or enough still shots. I mean, there was no reason to lie about it. You just kind of like Nikki Haley locked herself out. I mean, she kidded about it. He would have been better off kidding about it, but that's not who he is. Catherine,
yeah, he's not that
what
bad.
Do you make of this?
Well, people make mistakes. I mean, like, you're absolutely right. It would have been much better if he just said, oh, I forgot, haha, and just move on and sign it and make a joke about it and be done with it. But to try to cover it up and make new photos and all that just makes it look worse. It just makes him look, he's just got no sense of humor about himself. He takes himself much too seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of harken back to Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon. Gerald Ford was portrayed as goofy. Richard Nixon was portrayed as shady. It's a lot better to be goofy than shady. Tim, what do you think of this non-signature and then the cover-up? I mean, it was no crime. It was just a faux pas.
Yeah.
But
what
was this cover-up?
Unfortunately for Donald Trump, there was video of the incident and plenty of it, I might add, and it was dutifully shown on all the networks despite the fact that they staged this thing after, and what y'all have said is true. The man has no sense of humor with regard to himself. He cannot laugh at himself. He takes himself too seriously. There's no humility about the man at all. And this sort of thing just goes on and on and on with him. And it's going to keep going on and on with him. The public opinion polls on a variety of subjects are really, really now starting to reflect that. For instance, Trump's been hollering, find the leakers, in regards to this investigation. But now we see a poll where by like 52-23%, the American people want an independent investigation of the ties with Russia. He's losing these arguments, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That poll I saw that. I mean, it was only 23% don't want an investigation. There was another,
right.
You know, 22% that was kind of, you know, not ready to commit. But you can tell that they're not ready to defend him either. So, I mean, he has about
right.
a quarter of the population firmly on his side no matter what. And yeah, that's 75%
but,
then not firmly on his side.
Well, look, today his approval rating was 38%. His disapproval rating has been at or above 55% now since March the 10th. I mean, maybe he's losing on these issues because his arguments are so absurd. Maybe people are finally starting to say, hey, you know, this guy is absurd. What do you think, Catherine? Am I on the right track?
Well, I think
here?
when he blames the loss on the health care bill on the Democrats, I think that didn't help his credibility much. I mean, everybody was like, "What is he?" I mean, even your most you know devoted Republican hears that and says, "What the heck is he talking about?" Like. It had nothing to do with the Democrats. It was the conservative, you know, Republicans that didn't like him, like the bill.
I mean, we can count. We can count, can't we? There's 193 of us, and that's it.
Yeah.
There's 240 of them that were there for that vote. Well, duh, you know.
Yeah, and he never asked for their vote, never asked for their support, never
right.
made any kind of overture to get support from the Democrats because he, you know, he thought, and well, he should have thought that he had the support of the Republicans, but he didn't.
Yeah, well, and,
so.
And honestly, he did blame the Democrats, but he blamed some other people. He blamed the Freedom Caucus, the most conservative Republicans. He blamed Paul Ryan. He blamed Rance Priebus behind the scenes. He probably blamed Sean Spicer. He blamed his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, for going skiing. He blamed everybody he could find except for that one gentleman that looks in the mirror every day. And that seems to be his modus operandi. And I tell you what, whether you're the most conservative person, the most liberal person, or the most moderate person, a lot of people are just not big fans of leaders who can never take any blame. That's
right.
All,
yeah.
You know, external locus of control. It's usually a sign of a person that's not well-adjusted or not well, very mature. And by the time you're 70-something years old, probably a little late if you have. And so we're ready.
Well,
we're willing to, you know, wanting to, I think somebody see, I made a mistake sometimes. I mean, it happens. Everybody does.
You know, David, yeah. David, we can look at a historical reference right there. One that comes to mind for me immediately is the Bay of Pigs, which was just an outright debacle early in John Kennedy's presidency. He steps up to the podium and he says, you know, they say that victory has 1,000 fathers and defeat is an orphan. And then he stood there and he took total responsibility for what happened. And what happened as a result? His approval numbers actually went up. Because he owned what he did. You're right, David, what you're saying. This guy should own his own presidency, and he's just not doing it. And that means failures with successes. And I'm sorry to say the successes have been sparse, to put it charitably.
Yeah,
and you wonder if this is not...
Yeah, another problem with this healthcare thing with Donald Trump is I don't think there's a certain, you know, solution he favors. He just wants to call something a success. If they flavored all tongue depressors in America, great, or they gave everybody a free box of Band-Aids and they called it the most wonderful healthcare solution and Donald Trump got the credit, he'd be happy. In the same token, if
right.
he went to single-payer healthcare coverage and he got the credit, he might be healthy. I mean, happy. He just wants to get the credit no matter what it is. And that's what may frustrate people on both sides of the aisle.
What's he doing in the way of legwork to get any of these victories? I mean, what is he doing in the way of work to get it done?
He's
I don't
golfing.
Know if he's walking 18 holes or driving. I don't know which one he's doing on the weekend.
What would you say?
Don't you know all problems are solved on the golf course?
Yeah. And what's so funny is I really don't care if somebody plays golf. It's you know, maybe in D.C. so they can still be at the White House, and they like to play once every weekend, once every other weekend they get in half a course, a full 18 holes, and it relaxes them so they can be better at their job. I don't think that's a problem, but it's when you have to fly down four states away and then eating your own little steakhouse, I guess order their taco bowl down there, and you can never just go and go to somewhere around your place of work, D.C., where you probably need to be working a few weekends since you're the leader of the free world. Unfortunately, it's not a 9-to-5, 40-hour job. And if they told you that, they lied to you. Your opponent sure wouldn't have thought it was. She probably would have needed to be told to go relax because she would have worked too much. But it's just really sad. Well, Tim, you're running the board, but I bet we're in overtime, right?
We are. We just passed 8 o'clock. So.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and call it a night, and we'll be back next week on the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, all.
Good night, guys.
Good evening, everybody.